Our next case on calendar this morning is Barrington versus State, 68517. Once counsel have gotten themselves in place, we will take this matter up. Ms. Butko, if you're ready to proceed.
Good morning. Thank you. Carla Butko and Brent Butko here on behalf of Ms. Barrington. She is present in court this morning. This appeal revolves around a very strangely worded Nevada statute. We are all familiar with some of those, so this morning we're going to talk about one that involves criminal liability for the word might. Factually, this case arose when my client was on her own piece of property, 5-acre parcel of land in Silver Springs. It's a sandy piece of property. She has horses, fowl, chickens, exotic ducks, and they're in a pen. She also has a corral. It's 100 yards between her house and her neighbor's. That's a football field for those of us that love Sunday football. So she is on her property. She sees a dog, which the state describes as a chihuahua. It's actually a mini pincher chihuahua. And it is running, hazing is the term Miss Barrington uses, up and down her poultry pen. She yells at it. It doesn't move. She goes in the house and she gets her 25 caliber handgun, fits in the palm of her hand. Being a former animal control officer, she doesn't want to kill the dog. She just wants it to leave her fowl alone. So she points downrange, shoots at the sand next to the dog, doesn't hit the dog. The dog then turns and starts barking at her. It's not phased. It doesn't leave. And she is shooing it back to its property owner. That's the testimony the jury heard. They also heard very confusing testimony. Very clearly, Ms. Barrington admitted to the police, I fired one shot on my land in the direction of a dog that was harassing my poultry. And we don't care how big that dog is. I grew up on a farm. One tiny little skunk can wipe out 100 chickens in a night. Not because it eats them, because it scares them to
death. This dog probably was between 5 and 10 pounds or so at the most.
Don't know.
Miniature pincher chihuahua. The biggest chihuahua is 10 pounds.
Don't know.
The teacup chihuahuas are 5 pounds, so it's going to be a tiny dog. I mean, how the heck is it a threat to poultry? It's inside a pen.
The threat is that it runs, and it causes the poultry to overheat and overexercise and get over-concerned and die of a heart attack. It's not a threat that it's going to eat it. It's a threat that it's going to scare it to death. So when she shoots this gun, the law says you can be convicted of discharging a firearm at a place where a person might be endangered. Might. The key to that language is that she could stand convicted right here today for that one shot where nobody was downrange, there was no danger to anybody except herself on her own piece of land. Is this where we are in America? Where you can own a 5-acre mini ranch, but if you fire a gun to protect your animals, and you are the only person at risk for a misfire, you can be convicted.
Was that not the issue, though, for the jury to determine, based upon all the facts put in the evidence?
The interesting thing about the jury instructions on this case.
Counsel, it wasn't about the jury instructions, but wasn't a factual representation made that the neighbors, there was a certain concern?
Yes. So the second shot, which my client disputes ever happened, and she had a witness who testified never happened, there's two neighbors next to her. One is a gentleman named Mr. Madden. He says he heard the first shot. He was with the 4-year-old child of his girlfriend's son. And he sent the son home on his own. So he's not seeing any danger in this setting, or he would not send that child to go home without help. So he's not seeing any danger. In fact, he goes to investigate. He goes to argue with my client. He's not seeing any danger. Mr. Harris across the street, who my client had a TPO against that the jury never got to hear. Mr. Harris across the street heard the first shot, was in his house, didn't see the first shot, and didn't see the second shot because he was blocked by a corner. He heard a second shot. And then at preliminary hearing, he said he heard 2, 3, or 4 shots. By the time he got to trial, he heard 2 for sure, maybe 3. His testimony was completely incredible. But no one sees. And if we take their testimony just at face value, Mr. Madden says Ms. Barrington has a gun in her hand and is waving it around and it discharges. Mr. Harris can't see it, but when he does see anything, he sees her with her arms moving. Nobody sees anybody being endangered by the second shot. So if there was a second shot, which we dispute, it was an accidental discharge. We get to a statute that says a person might have been endangered. It doesn't tell the jury what person has to be endangered. So it could have been the jury decided she was guilty because she endangered herself by handling of the weapon. If so, that can't stand. So when we look at the case, we look at 2 conflicting statutes, and the judge attempted to try to marry them. Ms. Barrington has a right to protect her fowl on her property. The judge decided she could not do that if it would endanger a person. Now, a person, that definition includes her. So what do we have now? We go hunting. Nevada's a hunting state. One of my friends went up this season, heard her husband hunt on horses, rode into the Rubies, only to find out there were so many hunters out there they didn't feel safe. So they went home. And they did it the next weekend, and they felt the same way and went home. All those other hunters didn't feel that they were endangering anybody's life by shooting at deer or elk or whatever they were hunting up there. But my friend did. Now, if those people had been arrested, might someone have been endangered? You bet. A shooting gun range. Misfires happen all the time. Is it illegal to go to a shooting gun? Shoot a gun at a range? No. But under this statute, a police officer could arrest you if he thought it was endangering someone. Where do we draw the line? So now we know in Lyon County, on your own 5-acre lot, shooting in the sand on your own property, you can be arrested if we take the evidence as the appellant says it is. On your own land, protecting your own fowl, what if she was shooting at a coyote? Would that change your opinion? There's coyotes all over. There's coyotes in my neighborhood. They walk down and they look at me like they're a dog. If I shot one, might I endanger someone? Might is the problem with the statute. So the question is to try to infer intent. So we have a generic intent statute that says every act must be united with a criminal intent. But then we have a judge that takes it the next step, where the willful element is not in the charging document. So the jury is told, strict liability offense. The word willful appears in the statute, but not in the charge against my client at jury instruction 4.
Where is that willful at, Counselor?
Willful?
Yes.
Yes, willful is in the statute in 199-290. It says a person who willfully, and then we go to section 2 for this case. But the charging document
didn't
have it.
Is the willful as to the firing of the weapon, or is your position the willful is as to firing a weapon at a person?
I think you have to have knowledge. So here's the question. I think that's the great question. What the jury in here was instructed was if she willfully discharged that gun, we don't care whether she knew or had reason to know a person could be endangered. We don't care. But we do care because we have the Clancy decision, which is a hit-and-run case, which basically says when you leave the scene of that accident, you have to know you were in an accident, know or have reason to know. The jury was not instructed any sort of interpretation that she should know it was a dangerous setting for a handgun. They were instructed a person is a human being. and a person might be endangered by a willful discharge of a firearm. So our position is that's overbroad and it's void for vagueness. The question on this case also becomes one of enforcement. Anything goes. You can see the misuses that this statute could come in and be found. This isn't a congested area. This isn't an area where you come into a small community, it says discharge of firearms prohibited, you're put on notice. This is private property, large parcels. Let's take it out to a ranch. And a rancher has 500 acres. And he shoots at a pack of wild dogs. There's another rancher a ways away. Is he guilty? Yes. Under this offense and under this interpretation, he'd be guilty. And yet what he's doing is done every day in Nevada out of necessity. So we have discriminatory enforcement completely
available. What about the issue of cumulative error? I notice there's other issues that you've raised. What about cumulative?
This is a case where cumulative error really is appropriate. We have insufficient evidence. We have two and two as far as the witnesses go. We have no police investigation, none at all. They don't even bother to ask, you know, take the gun, get a warrant to get the gun. They don't look for casings. They do no investigation, no pictures, no nothing, and it's daylight. There's no excuse for the lazy work done on this case. The defense witness wanted to talk to the police. They didn't even talk to him, for heaven's sakes. So we have that. We know for a fact that the evidence is highly conflicted. And then we have the statements in the closing of the state at closing. And normally I try not to hit prosecutorial misconduct because usually it's a dead dog loser. But in this particular case, when you have close evidence, and then you have the state calling the defense witness pretty much everything but a liar, every synonym you could think of, and comments during the questioning of that witness, like, I have no more use for this witness. Things like that tip the hand. And so in this case, Mr. Johnson made several statements. I don't see this. I believe that. I think this. All of which are inappropriate comment on the evidence.
What about the seating of the alternate juror?
You know, this is an area that I'm so looking forward to when we have rules of criminal procedure, because anything goes in these district courts on how an alternate gets put on up there to work. And in this case, basically the alternate was sworn the day before as an alternate juror. The one juror goes up, that one comes in, and nothing is said. And I think you need to swear the juror in to do their job fairly. And there's no rules. So we need some rules, and I'm looking forward to that day. And I'm kind of trying to keep the last 3 minutes for Mr. Butko to synopsize. Thank you.
Thank you. On behalf of the state.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Jeremy Reichenberg, and I'm here for the respondent, Lyon County. May it please the court. May it please counsel. Nevada's Discharging a Firearm Act has been on the books since the 1911 Crime and Punishment Act. And for 105 years, this statute has prohibited the willful discharge of a firearm in any place where any person might be endangered thereby. 105 years, the citizens of the state of Nevada have understood what is prescribed. For 105 years, people who have violated this statute in the state have been convicted. This is not the usual case of a new ordinance or a technological change that is responded to by the legislature where someone challenges it. This is a statute that has been with us for a great deal of time. And again, statutes are presumed to be valid, and the challenger bears the burden to show they must make a clear showing of invalidity. And in this case, the appellants cannot do that.
Counsel has described this as a situation where the party's on her own property. In her best light, it's a discharge into the ground. How was someone threatened? How do you respond to her colorization of this?
Well, Your Honor, I'd respond by quoting from the appellant's appendix at page 580, the sentencing transcript. From the judge in sentencing, And the judge said, I understand that you're at wit's end, but frankly, I didn't buy your testimony either as to I calmly pointed the gun down at the ground. You lost it. He goes on further, and then you decided you were going to pull out the gun, and you pointed it in the direction that you did, and there were people downrange. There's a lot of time spent in the briefing talking about insufficiency of the evidence. But in this case, there's not an insufficiency of the evidence. What they're really saying is there's a conflict in the stories. And the appellants did point that out, that there is two and two. There is the individual who was out looking for his chihuahua when these shots happened. The neighbor across the street who heard the gunfire in his own house, heard the first shot and came out and then observed the second shot. And then there is the appellant and then the individual who comes forward about a year later and saying, I saw this whole thing from my roof. And there was a question earlier about the facts for the jury. And in this case, the jury heard two conflicting stories, as is often the case in a trial. And they made a determination as to the facts. And it's interesting to note that Clancy, or I'm sorry, not the Clancy case, but the Walker case in the briefings, because there's a discussion about insufficiency of the evidence versus conflict of the evidence and what the judge can do in that case. And it's interesting to note that, again, the judge in this case, having sat through the testimony and heard the testimony of the witnesses there in that trial court, essentially sums up nicely exactly what the jury found, is that, and then the appellant makes great pains to say this was a shot into the sand, a very carefully placed shot. But the two other eyewitnesses who testified for the state said this was a running through the sagebrush, firing off rounds from a gun. And it is clear that that is what the jury, there's two versions of this event, and it's clear that that's what the jury, and in this case the judge, saw as far as the factual basis.
There was no testimony as to how many shots were fired as far as police investigation was concerned. They didn't find three shells versus two shells versus one shell?
No, Your Honor. And that leads to the claim of the failure to collect evidence. And, Your Honor, I would note that In the Gordon case, this court has found that in a criminal investigation, police officers generally have no duty to collect all potential evidence. And it says that this evidence, this rule is not absolute. And I think it's important to see, again, kind of to imagine this property and what was going on at this time. The testimony at the trial was that the officer was dispatched around 6:18 or 6:19 p.m. Sunset was about 7:08 p.m. He was responding to it, to this complaint of shots fired, and had witnesses to talk to, and that when he went and spoke to appellant, he asked her about her side of the events, that she gave a statement, and that by the time he cleared that scene, it's dark. And so would it have been nice to know, to find every one of these casings? Would it have been nice to find whether it's one shot, one casing, or two casings on this 5-acre parcel? And it would have. Quite honestly, I think it would have benefited the state quite a bit more. But the fact that this was not found, it's not a there's three types of failure to collect evidence. There's neglect, gross neglect, and there's bad faith. And I think it arguably doesn't even rise to the neglect level when you have an officer who goes out to the property and, again, the appellant has every right to say, get off my property, you can't have my property, don't search my property. But for the appellant to then say, the officer didn't either A, violate my rights and say, I'm going to search your property even though you don't want me to be here, or B, that he chose not to go to the court and seize property when she had already asked him to leave, essentially. I don't think that rises above possibly a negligence, but it's clearly, I don't think rises to gross negligence or bad faith, which the appellants are arguing here. They miss a step there.
The record doesn't the record say something in terms of the officer at least asking for the gun?
Yes, Your Honor. And again, it's the other part of this is that they have to show that the outcome would have been different on the failure to gather evidence. And so the appellant made the statement to the officer, and the question is what could be shown by gathering this evidence? And admittedly, no one knows, I don't believe there's any testimony about how many rounds were in the firearm when it was before it was initially discharged. So whether you maintain a firearm with a fully loaded magazine or whether you have less than fully loaded, I don't think that when she says, no, you can't look at this, and he doesn't come back to get a search warrant, whether or not that would have been indicative. And the other thing is, can you even find a piece of evidence that small in a five-acre parcel? I mean, I think it's quite common in shooting cases where it's difficult to find all the projectiles. It's difficult to find all of the spent casings. It's almost literally a needle in a haystack in a situation like this.
Is it your position that if it was one shot, she's not guilty? If it's two shots, she's guilty?
No, Your Honor.
So your position is if it's one shot, she's guilty of this under the statute?
In these circumstances, the facts as they were presented to the jury and there's two scenarios, obviously. The scenario that the jury found to be the case, she is guilty, Your Honor. And the reason for that is, again, there is distance between the houses in this area. But the issue is there is a house there. There's a house where the facts were uncontroverted that the appellant and Mr. Madden knew each other. The appellant knew that Mr. Madden had children, a four-year-old and then a teenager, and she's outside popping off rounds in the direction of his house in where she knew there would be people there. And not only that, in this case, Mr. Madden was actually out looking for his dog. This is not a case where the dog had been out roaming around for days or even hours. The dog escaped. The owner went looking for it, and he's met essentially by gunfire. His testimony was that the second shot occurred when he was 10 feet away. And there's a lot of drive to try to characterize this as, well, if you go to a gun range, then you could be held liable because there could be a misfire or ricochet. There are scenarios where you could be held liable if you go to the gun range and don't do what you're supposed to do, that action. If you go out here to the dump and instead of firing into the berm, you turn your gun sideways down the lane, yes, in fact, you could be discharging your firearm in a place where a person might be endangered. It's a fact-specific inquiry, and the jury looked at the facts in this case, and they made that determination as to what her conduct was, what her action was in the discharge. And, Your Honor, it's important in this case also to reference the Holland case, where this court has previously said that prescribed action, the prohibited action in this case, is a negligent type of action. This is not a situation where you're prescribing that type of intentional placing a single person in danger. That the thing that we're preventing here is the negligent use of a firearm, and I think that goes directly into the instructions in this case and what the instructions said. And I would also note, too, and this kind of goes for almost the entirety of the appellant's arguments, is that there were no objections at trial to any of the issues that are raised now. There's no objections to the comments of the prosecutor. There were at least the ones that have been called out. There was no objections to the instructions. In fact, these were stipulated to, and it's replete over and over in the appendix that the defense stipulated to these wordings. And it is because, I believe, of this Holland case and the understanding that what's prescribed here is negligent conduct. And so when The instructions indicate about the state does not need to prove a defendant willfully endangered any person in 7, and then you have 9 where it says you don't have to endanger a particular person. This is an understanding and a reflection of the fact that this is not assault with a deadly weapon. This is not a situation where you, the jury had to find that either Mr. Madden himself was the person placed in danger or his son was the one who was particularly placed in danger. It is any person who might be placed in danger. And so the fact that she is out there running through the desert, shooting rounds in the direction of someone's house is a situation where the jury can, as fact finder, and did find that her conduct violated this statute, and she was found guilty.
You wish to comment on the issue as to the alternate juror and prosecutorial misconduct that was raised?
Yes, Your Honor. As far as the seating of the alternate juror, the way that this occurred and the swearing of the jury and the jury sitting through the entirety of the proceedings and then being substituted out, I don't think there is an issue there as far as whether or not this juror knew that they needed to take their responsibility seriously. They had been selected as a juror. They were sitting there in the...
Wasn't the alternate sworn in at the same time the 12 regular jurors were sworn in?
Yes, Your Honor, exactly. It's a swearing in of everyone who's in that box, and they are all in that box. It's essentially just where they happen to be seated. And then once the person who's on the regular 12 it left, then they moved down.
Well, I didn't quite understand Ms. Butko's argument. Maybe they can clarify, but I think the way I understand it, the alternates are sworn in just as regular jurors. If the judge substitutes an alternate for a regular juror for whatever reason during the trial, they've already sworn in. They've heard the whole trial. I don't know, understand the issue here.
Yes, Your Honor. There is not like a separate, you are an alternate, you are a juror swearing in process. It is you are being sworn in, and having done a number of these trials in this particular courthouse, I sometimes don't know that if, unless you understand the process, that you even know that you're necessarily an alternate. Everyone is sitting right there together. And it is not delineated, you are an alternate right now, you are actually on the 12.
Well, they don't know until the judge tells them at the end of before the deliberations start. You know?
Correct, Your Honor. And at that point, the alternates are called to the side, and their numbers are given, and they say, we'll call you if we need you, and the 12 are sent back to the back room. So to say that there needs to be some sort of other special admonishment or something like that, I don't think that is necessary. I don't think it is something that needs to happen. As far as the prosecutorial misconduct, again, nothing was objected to at the time of trial. And as far as the
finish your thought.
Thank you. And as far as the arguments go, especially as regards to the witness who observed everything from the rooftop. Again, it did not cross the bounds of what this court has said. There was no, he's a liar, he lied. All the comments were in the context of the evidence and the testimony that he provided and the facts surrounding what he said he could have seen, as well as the people who he said he talked to, which there was no corroboration for. And so all of the comments were in context. Thank you very much.
Rebuttal, please.
Good morning, Justices. If it please the Court, may I begin? All right. Opposing counsel's first argument to you was that simply because a statute is old, it must therefore be constitutional. Clearly, such a position is not true. I imagine a number of the cases and statutes that began in 1911 are no longer valid law today. Now, the word might is constitutionally unconscionable. Simply put, if I told my wife that I might show up at her birthday party, she would ask for more clarification. This statute does not ask for more clarification. All it asks is if it might endanger a human being. Any gun might misfire. Any gun might ricochet. Any discharge of any firearm can endanger a human being, which means that the word might effectively reads out the second half of the statute. So, Justice Douglas, back to your initial question as to whether the question if it endangers a human being is left to the jury, it's not. Under the terms of this statute, any discharge might endanger a human being, so the jury is left only to determine whether the gun was fired willfully. Which leads me to my next comment on sufficiency of the evidence. The only evidence of the second gunshot were that individuals Madden and Harris heard the gunshot fired and witnessed her running. There is no evidence produced by the state that the gunshots were willful, and as recently as 3 months ago in Barber v. State, it was recognized by this court that the failure of the state to prove a necessary element is insufficient evidence to convict. Therefore, the second bullet shot, if any, had insufficient evidence to convict a trial. Now, regarding the first bullet shot, the only witness to that shot was my client herself, Ms. Barrington, who testified that she shot it into soft sand no more than 20 feet away at a shallow angle, which was confirmed by the detective in this case to not be a dangerous shot. So the first shot was also confirmed not to endanger a human being, even though it was willful. So there is clearly insufficient evidence to convict my client in this matter. Moving on, the duty to collect evidence was discussed by opposing counsel. He said and noted that there is no duty to collect all potential evidence, but assuredly there is a duty to collect some potential evidence. Taking a single witness statement for a shots plural fired when she admitted to firing only one shot is not enough evidence collected to convict her on more than one shot, which is what he was called there for.
Counsel, in that, as you point that issue out, did the police not attempt to retrieve the weapon?
They tried to retrieve the weapon, and of course my client, being a firm believer in her constitutional rights, stated that they did not have a warrant and could not seize her property without such. Now, are we supposed to take her invocation of a constitutional right as an admission of guilt? I don't think so.
But doesn't that go to the police making an attempt to procure?
If he really desired
to take into consideration.
May I answer your question, Your Honor?
Go ahead.
Okay. If he really wanted to acquire the weapon and see how many shots were fired and do his due diligence, he should have thence acquired a warrant, which was fully able to do. I'm sure a judge would have given him a warrant for a shots plural fired when she admitted to a single shot, if, of course, the state contends that there's sufficient evidence to convict. All right.
If you have a closing thought, give us your closing thought.
I'm sorry, sir?
If you have a closing thought, please give us your closing thought.
No more than I would just like to rephrase what I said earlier, that the word might in a criminal statute is unconstitutional. Thank you, Justices.
Thank you. We appreciate the arguments advanced by counsel this morning. It gives us something to think about as we take this matter into consideration. This matter stands submitted. We are in recess.